he saw the tissue moving gently with the tide of life around its minuscule gullet. If nothing else, he thought, and wrote later in his Popular Mechanics article, it would make a wonderful diagnostic tool. Then he noticed that the tidal movement of the tissues had ceased. The mouse had died. Karun pulled the mouse out by the snout, not liking the feel of it, and dropped it into the paper sack with its companions.
Enough with the white mice, he decided. The mice die. They die if you put them through all the way, and they die if you put them through halfway head first. Put them through halfway butt first, they stay frisky. What the hell is in there?
Sensory input, he thought almost randomly. When they go through, they see something, hear something, touch something. God, maybe even smell something that literally kills them. What?
He had no idea, but he meant to find out. Karun still had almost 40 minutes before Comlink pulled the database out from under him. He unscrewed the thermometer from the wall beside his kitchen door, trotted back to the barn with it, and put it through the portals. The thermometer went in at 83 degrees Fahrenheit. It came out at 83 degrees Fahrenheit. He rummaged through the spare room where he kept a few toys to amuse his grandchildren with. Among them, he found a packet of balloons. He blew one of them up, tied it off, and batted it through the portal. It came out intact and unharmed. A start down the road toward answering his question about a sudden change in pressure somehow caused by what he was already thinking of as the jaunting process. With 5 minutes to go before the witching hour, he ran into his house, snatched up his goldfish bowl. Inside, Percy and Patrick swished their tails and darted about in agitation and ran back with it. He shoved the goldfish bowl through Portal 1. He hurried across to Portal 2, where his goldfish bowl sat on the crate. Patrick was floating belly up. Percy swam slowly around near the bottom of the bowl as if dazed. A moment later, he also floated belly up. Karun was reaching for the goldfish bowl when Percy gave a weak flick of his tail and resumed his lackadaisical swimming. Slowly, he seemed to throw off whatever the effect had been, and by the time Karun got back from Moscone's veterinary clinic that night at 9 o'clock, Percy seemed as perky as ever. Patrick was dead. Karun fed Percy a double ration of fish food and gave Patrick a hero's burial in the garden. After the computer had cut him out for the day, Karun decided to hitch a ride over to Moscone's. Accordingly, he was standing on the shoulder of Route 26 at 4:15 that afternoon, dressed in jeans and a loud plaid sport coat, his thumb out, a paper bag in his other hand. Finally, a kid driving a Chevette not much bigger than a sardine can pulled over, and Karun got in.
"What you got in the bag, my man?"
"Bunch of dead mice," Karun said. Eventually, another car stopped. When the farmer behind the wheel asked about the bag, Karun told him it was a couple of sandwiches. Moscone dissected one of the mice on the spot and agreed to dissect the others later and call Karun on the telephone with the results. The initial result was not very encouraging. So far as Moscone could tell, the mouse he had opened up was perfectly healthy except for the fact that it was dead.
Depressing.
Victor Karun was eccentric, but he was no fool, Mark said.
The jaunt attendants were getting close now, and he supposed he would have to hurry up, or he would be finishing this in the wake-up room in Whitehead City.
Hitching a ride back home that night, and he had to walk most of the way, so the story goes,
he realized that he had maybe solved a third of the energy crisis at one single stroke. All the goods that had to go by train and truck and boat and plane before that day could be jaunted. You could write a letter to your friend in London or Rome or Senegal, and he could have it the very next day without an ounce of oil needing to be burned. We take it for granted, but it was a big thing to Karun, believe me, and to everyone else as well.
But what happened to the mice, Daddy? Rick asked.
That's what Karun kept asking himself, Mark said, because he also realized that if people could use the jaunt, that would solve almost all of the energy crisis, and that we might be able to conquer space. In his Popular Mechanics article, he said that even the stars could finally be ours, and the metaphor he used was crossing a shallow stream without getting your shoes wet.
You'd just get a big rock and throw it in the stream. Then get another rock, stand on the first rock, and throw that into the stream. Go back and get a third rock. Go back to the second rock, throw the third rock into the stream, and keep up like that until you'd made a path of stepping stones all the way across the stream. Or in this case, the solar system. Or maybe even the galaxy.
I don't get that at all, Patty said. That's because you got turkey turds for brains, Ricky said smugly. I do not. Daddy, Ricky said children, don't, Marilis said gently.
Karun pretty much foresaw what has happened, Mark said. Drone rocket ships programmed to land, first on the moon, then on Mars, then on Venus and the outer moons of Jupiter. Drones really only programmed to do one thing after they landed.
Set up a jaunt station for astronauts, Ricky said.
Mark nodded. And now there are scientific outposts all over the solar system, and maybe someday, long after we're gone, there will even be another planet for us. There are jaunt ships on their way to four different star systems with solar systems of their own. But it'll be a long, long time before they get there.
I want to know what happened to the mice, Patty said impatiently.
Well, eventually the government got into it, Mark said. Karun kept them out as long as he could, but finally they got wind of it and landed on him with both feet. Karun was nominal head of the jaunt project until he died 10 years later, but he was never really in charge of it again.
Geez, the poor guy, Rick said. But he got to be a hero, Patricia said. He's in all the history books, just like President Lincoln and President Hart.
I'm sure that's a great comfort to him, wherever he is, Mark thought, and then went on, carefully glossing over the rough parts. The government, which had been pushed to the wall by the escalating energy crisis, did indeed come in with both feet. They wanted the jaunt on a paying basis as soon as possible, like yesterday. Faced with economic chaos and the increasingly probable picture of anarchy and mass starvation in the 1990s, only last-ditch pleading made them put off announcement of the jaunt before an exhaustive spectrographic analysis of jaunted articles could be completed. When the analyses were complete and showed no changes in the makeup of jaunted artifacts, the existence of the jaunt was announced with international hoopla. Showing intelligence for once, necessity is, after all, the mother of invention, the U.S. government put Young and Rubicam in charge of the PR. That was where the myth-making around Victor Karun, an elderly, rather peculiar man who showered perhaps twice a week and changed his clothes only when he thought of it, began. Young and Rubicam and the agencies which followed them turned Karun into a combination of Thomas Edison, Eli Whitney, Pecos Bill, and Flash Gordon. The blackly funny part of all this, and Mark Oates did not pass this on to his family, was that Victor Karun might even then have been dead or insane. Art imitates life, they say, and Karun would have been familiar with the Robert Heinlein novel about the doubles who stand in for figures in the public eye. Victor Karun was a problem. A nagging problem that wouldn't go away. He was a loud-mouthed foot-dragger, a holdover from the ecological 60s, a time when there was still enough energy floating around to allow foot-dragging as a luxury. These, on the other hand, were the nasty 80s, with coal clouds befouling the sky and a long section of California coastline expected to be uninhabitable for perhaps 60 years due to a nuclear excursion. Victor Karun remained a problem until about 1991, and then he became a rubber stamp, smiling, quiet, grandfatherly, a figure seen waving from podiums in news films. In 1993, 3 years before he officially died, he rode in the pace car at the Tournament of Roses parade. Puzzling, and a little ominous. The results of the announcement of the jaunt of working teleportation on October 19, 1988 was a hammerstroke of worldwide excitement and economic upheaval. On the world money markets, the battered old American dollar suddenly skyrocketed through the roof. People who had bought gold at $806 an ounce suddenly found that a pound of gold would bring something less than $1,200. In the year between the announcement of the jaunt and the first working jaunt stations in New York and L.A., the stock market climbed a little over 1,000 points. The price of oil dropped only 70 cents a barrel, but by 1994, with jaunt stations crisscrossing the U.S. at the pressure points of 70 major cities, OPEC had ceased to exist, and the price of oil began to tumble. By 1998, with stations in most free world cities and goods routinely jaunted between Tokyo and Paris, Paris and London, London and New York, New York and Berlin, oil had dropped to $14 a barrel. By 2006, when people at last began to use the jaunt on a regular basis, the stock market had leveled off 5,000 points above its 1987 levels. Oil was selling for $6 a barrel, and the oil companies had begun to change their names. Texaco became Texaco Oil Water, and Mobil had become Mobil Hydro 2-Ox. By 2045, water prospecting became the big game, and oil had become what it had been in 1906, a toy.
"What about the mice, Daddy?" Patty asked impatiently. "What happened to the mice?"
Mark decided it might be okay now, and he drew the attention of his children to the jaunt attendants who were passing gas out only 3 aisles from them. Rick only nodded, but Patty looked troubled as a lady with a fashionably shaved and painted head took a whiff from the rubber mask and fell unconscious.
"Can't jaunt when you're awake, can you, Dad?" Ricky said.
Mark nodded and smiled reassuringly at Patricia. "Karoon understood even before the government got into it," he said.
"How did the government get into it, Mark?" Marilis asked.
Mark smiled. "Computer time," he said. "The database. That was the only thing that Karoon couldn't beg, borrow, or steal. The computer handled the actual particulate transmission, billions of pieces of information. It's still the computer, you know, that makes sure you don't come through with your head somewhere in the middle of your stomach."
Marilis shuddered.
"Don't be frightened," he said. "There's never been a screw-up like that, Mare. Never."
"There's always a first time," she muttered.
Mark looked at Ricky. "How did he know?" he asked his son. "How did Karoon know you had to be asleep, Rick?"
"When he put the mice in backwards," Rick said slowly, "they were all right. At least as long as he didn't put them all in. They were only, well, messed up when he put them in head first, right?"
"Right," Mark said. The jaunt attendants were moving in now, wheeling their silent cart of oblivion. He wasn't going to have time to finish after all. Perhaps it was just as well. It didn't take many experiments to clarify what was happening, of course. The jaunt killed the entire trucking business, kids, but at least it took the pressure off the experimenters. Yes, foot dragging had become a luxury again, and the tests had gone on for better than 20 years, although Karoon's first tests with drugged mice had convinced him that unconscious animals were not subject to what was known forever after as the organic effect, or more simply, the jaunt effect. He and Moscone had drugged several mice, put them through Portal 1, retrieved them at the other side, and had waited anxiously for their test subjects to reawaken, or to die. They had reawakened, and after a brief recovery period they had taken up their mouse lives, eating, fucking, playing, and shitting, with no ill effects whatsoever. Those mice became the first of several generations which were studied with great interest. They showed no long-term ill effects. They did not die sooner. Their pups were not born with two heads or green fur, and neither did these pups show any other long-term effects.
"When did they start with people, Dad?" Rick asked, although he had certainly read this in school. "Tell that part."
"I want to know what happened to the mice," Patty said again.
Although the jaunt attendants had now reached the head of their aisle, they themselves were near the foot, Mark Oates paused a moment to reflect. His daughter, who knew less, had nevertheless listened to her heart and asked the right question. Therefore, it was his son's question he chose to answer. The first human jaunters had not been astronauts or test pilots. They were convict volunteers who had not even been screened with any particular interest in their psychological stability. In fact, It was the view of the scientists now in charge, Karun was not one of them, he had become what is commonly called a titular head, that the freakier they were, the better. If a mental spaz could go through and come out all right, or at least no worse than he or she had been going in, then the process was probably safe for the executives, politicians, and fashion models of the world. Half a dozen of these volunteers were brought to Provence, Vermont, a site which had since become every bit as famous as Kitty Hawk, North Carolina had once been, gassed, and fed through the portals exactly 2 hand miles apart, one by one. Mark told his children this because, of course, all 6 of the volunteers came back just fine and feeling perky, thank you. He did not tell them about the purported 7th volunteer. This figure, who might have been real or myth or, most probably, a combination of the two, even had a name. Rudy Foggia. Foggia was supposed to have been a convicted murderer, sentenced to death in the state of Florida for the murders of 4 old people at a Sarasota bridge party. According to the Apocrypha, the combined forces of the Central Intelligence Agency and the FBI had come to Foggia with a unique, one-time, take-it-or-leave-it, absolutely-not-to-be-repeated offer. Take the jaunt wide awake. Come through okay, and we put your pardon, signed by Governor Thurgood, in your hand. Out you walk, free to follow the one true cross or to off a few more old folks playing bridge in their yellow pants and white shoes. Come through dead or insane. Tough titty, as the kitty was purported to have said. What do you say? Foggia, who understood that Florida was one state that really meant business about the death penalty, and whose lawyer had told him that he was in all probability the next to ride old Sparky, said okay. Enough scientists to fill a jury box, with 4 or 5 left over as alternates, were present on the great day in the summer of 2007, but if the Foggia story was true, and Mark Oates believed it probably was, he doubted if it had been any of the scientists who talked. More likely, it had been one of the guards who had flown with Foggia from Rayford to Montpelier and then escorted him from Montpelier to Provence in an armored truck.
If I come through this alive, Foggia is reported to have said, I want a chicken dinner before I blow this joint.
He then stepped through Portal 1 and reappeared at Portal 2 immediately. He came through alive, but Rudy Foggia was in no condition to eat his chicken dinner. In the space it took to jaunt across the 2 miles, pegged at 0.000000000067 of a second by computer, Foggia's hair had turned snow white. His face had not changed in any physical way. It was not lined or jowly or wasted, but it gave the impression of great, almost incredible, age. Foggia shuffled out of the portal, his eyes bulging blankly, his mouth twitching, his hands splayed out in front of him. Presently he began to drool. The scientists who had gathered around drew away from him, and no, Mark really doubted if any of them had talked. They knew about the rats, after all, and the guinea pigs, and the hamsters. Any animal, in fact, with more brains than your average flatworm. They must have felt a bit like those German scientists who tried to impregnate Jewish women with the sperm of German shepherds.
What happened?
One of the scientists shouted, is reputed to have shouted. It was the only question Foggia had a chance to answer.
It's eternity in there,
he said, and dropped dead of what was diagnosed as a massive heart attack. The scientists foregathered there were left with his corpse, which was neatly taken care of by the CIA and the FBI, and that strange and awful dying declaration, it's eternity in there.
Daddy, I want to know what happened to the mice,
Patty repeated. The only reason she had a chance to ask again was because the man in the expensive suit and the Eternashine shoes had developed into something of a problem for the jaunt attendants. He didn't really want to take the gas, and was disguising it with a lot of bluff, bully boy talk. The attendants were doing their job as well as they could, smiling, cajoling, persuading, but it had slowed them down. Mark sighed. He had opened the subject, only as a way of distracting his children from the pre-jaunt festivities, it was true,
but he had opened it, and now he supposed he would have to close it as truthfully as he could without alarming them or upsetting them. He would not tell them, for instance, about C.K. Summers' book, The Politics of the Jaunt, which contained one section called The Jaunt Under the Rose, a compendium of the more believable rumors about the jaunt. The story of Rudy Foggia, he of the Bridge Club murders and the uneaten chicken dinner, was in there. There were also case histories of some other 30 or more or less, or who knows, volunteers, scapegoats, or madmen who had jaunted wide awake over the last 300 years. Most of them arrived at the other end dead. The rest were hopelessly insane. In some cases, the act of reemerging had actually seemed to shock them to death. Summers' section of jaunt rumors and apocrypha contained other unsettling intelligence as well. The jaunt had apparently been used several times as a murder weapon. In the most famous and only documented case, which had occurred a mere 30 years ago, a jaunt researcher named Lester Michelson had tied up his wife with their daughter's plexiplast dream ropes and pushed her screaming through the jaunt portal at Silver City, Nevada. But before doing it, Michelson had pushed the nil button on his jaunt board, erasing each and every one of the hundreds of thousands of possible portals through which Mrs. Michelson might have emerged, anywhere from neighboring Reno to the experimental jaunt station on Io, one of the Jovian moons. So there was Mrs. Michelson, jaunting forever somewhere out there in the ozone. Michelson's lawyer, after Michelson had been held sane and able to stand trial for what he had done, within the narrow limits of the law, perhaps he was sane, but in any practical sense, Lester Michelson was just as mad as a hatter, had offered a novel defense. His client could not be tried for murder, because no one could prove conclusively that Mrs. Michelson was dead. This had raised the terrible specter of the woman, discorporeal but somehow still sentient, screaming in limbo, forever. Michelson was convicted and executed. In addition, Summers suggested, the jaunt had been used by various tinpot dictators to get rid of political dissidents and political adversaries. Some thought that the mafia had their own illegal jaunt stations tied into the central jaunt computer through their CIA connections. It was suggested that the mafia used the jaunt's nil capability to get rid of bodies which, unlike that of the unfortunate Mrs. Michelson, were already dead. Seen in that light, the jaunt became the ultimate Jimmy Hoffa machine, ever so much better than the local gravel pit or quarry. All of this had led to Summers' conclusions and theories about the jaunt, and that, of course, led back to Patty's persistent question about the mice. "Well," Mark said slowly as his wife signaled with her eyes for him to be careful, "even now, no one really knows, Patty. But all the experiments with animals, including the mice, seemed to lead to the conclusion that while the jaunt is almost instantaneous physically, it takes a long, long time mentally."
"I don't get it," Patty said glumly. "I knew I wouldn't."
But Ricky was looking at his father thoughtfully.
"They went on thinking," he said. "The test animals. And so would we, if we didn't get knocked out."
"Yes," Mark said. "That's what we believe now." Something was dawning in Ricky's eyes.
Fright?
Excitement?
"It isn't just teleportation, is it, Dad? It's some kind of time warp."
"It's eternity in there," Mark thought. "In a way," he said. "But that's a comic book phrase. It sounds good, but doesn't really mean anything, Rick. It seems to revolve around the idea of consciousness and the fact that consciousness doesn't particulate. It remains whole and constant. It also retains some screwy sense of time. But we don't know how pure consciousness would measure time, or even if that concept has any meaning to pure mind. We can't even conceive what pure mind might be." Mark fell silent, troubled by his son's eyes, which were suddenly so sharp and curious. "He understands, but he doesn't understand," Mark thought. "Your mind can be your best friend. It can keep you amused even when there's nothing to read, nothing to do.
but it can turn on you when it's left with no input for too long. It can turn on you, which means that it turns on itself, savages itself, perhaps consumes itself in an unthinkable act of auto-cannibalism. How long in there, in terms of years? 0.00000000067 seconds for the body to jaunt, but how long for the unparticulated consciousness? 100 years? 1,000? 1,000,000? 1,000,000,000? How long, alone with your thoughts in an endless field of white? And then, when 1,000,000,000 eternities have passed, the crashing return of light and form and body. Who wouldn't go insane?
Ricky, he began, but the jaunt attendants had arrived with their cart.
Are you ready?
One asked. Mark nodded.
Daddy, I'm scared, Patty said in a thin voice. Will it hurt?
No, honey, of course it won't hurt, Mark said, and his voice was calm enough. But his heart was beating a little fast. It always did, although this would be something like his 25th jaunt. I'll go first, and you'll see how easy it is. The jaunt attendant looked at him questioningly. Mark nodded and made a smile. The mask descended. Mark took it in his own hands and breathed deep of the dark. The first thing he became aware of was the hard black Martian sky as seen through the top of the dome which surrounded Whitehead City. It was night here, and the stars sprawled with a fiery brilliance undreamed of on Earth. The second thing he became aware of was some sort of disturbance in the recovery room. Mutters, then shouts, then a shrill scream. Oh dear God, that's Marilis, he thought, and struggled up from his jaunt couch, fighting the waves of dizziness. There was another scream, and he saw jaunt attendants running toward their couches, their bright red jumpers flying around their knees. Marilis staggered toward him, pointing. She screamed again, and then collapsed on the floor, sending an unoccupied jaunt couch rolling slowly down the aisle with one weakly clutching hand. But Mark had already followed the direction of her pointing finger. He had seen. It hadn't been fright in Ricky's eyes. It had been excitement. He should have known, because he knew Ricky. Ricky, who had fallen out of the highest crotch of the tree in their backyard in Schenectady when he was only 7, who had broken his arm and was lucky that had been all he'd broken. Ricky, who dared to go faster and further on his slide board than any other kid in the neighborhood. Ricky, who was first to take any dare. Ricky and fear were not well acquainted. Until now. Beside Ricky, his sister still mercifully slept. The thing that had been his son bounced and writhed on its jaunt couch. A 12-year-old boy with a snow-white fall of hair and eyes which were incredibly ancient, the corneas gone a sickly yellow. Here was a creature older than time masquerading as a boy. And yet it bounced and writhed with a kind of horrid, obscene glee, and at its choked, lunatic cackles, the jaunt attendants drew back in terror. Some of them fled, although they had been trained to cope with just such an unthinkable eventuality. The old young legs twitched and quivered. Claw hands beat and twisted and danced on the air. Abruptly they descended, and the thing that had been his son began to claw at its face.
Longer than you think, Dad, it cackled. Longer than you think. Held my breath when they gave me the gas. Wanted to see. I saw. I saw. Longer than you think.
Cackling and screeching, the thing on the jaunt couch suddenly clawed its own eyes out. Blood gouted. The recovery room was an aviary of screaming voices now.
Longer than you think, Dad. I saw. I saw! Long jaunt! Longer than you think!
It said other things before the jaunt attendants were finally able to bear it away, rolling its couch swiftly away as it screamed and clawed at the eyes that had seen the unseeable forever and ever. It said other things, and then it began to scream. but Mark Oates didn't hear it, because by then he was screaming himself.
The Wedding Gig, read by Paul Giamatti.
In the year 1927, we were playing jazz in a speakeasy just south of Morgan, Illinois, a town 70 miles from Chicago. It was real hick country, not another big town for 20 miles in any direction. But there were a lot of farm boys with a hankering for something stronger than moxie after a hot day in the field, and a lot of would-be jazz babies outstepping with their drugstore cowboy boyfriends. There were also some married men. You always know them, friend. They might as well be wearing signs, coming far out of their way to be where no one would recognize them while they cut a rug with their not-quite-legit lassies. And that was when jazz was jazz, not noise. We had a 5-man combination, drums, cornet, trombone, piano, trumpet, and we were pretty good. And it was still 3 years before we made our first record, and 4 years before talkies. We were playing Bamboo Bay when this big fellow walked in, wearing a white suit and smoking a pipe with more squiggles in it than a French horn. The whole band was a little tight by that time, but everyone in the crowd was absolutely blind and really ramping the joint. They were in a good mood, though. Hadn't been a single fight all night. All of us guys were sweating rivers, and Tommy Englander, the guy who ran the place, kept sending up rye as smooth as a varnished plank. Englander was a good show to work for, and he liked our sound. Of course, that made him aces in my book. The guy in the white suit sat down at the bar, and I forgot him. We finished up the set with Ed Hager's Blues, which was a tune that passed for pretty racy out in the boondocks back then, and got a good round of applause. Manny had a big grin on his face when he put his trumpet down. I clapped him on the back as we left the bandstand. There was a lonely-looking girl in a green evening gown who'd be giving me the eye all night. She was a redhead, and I always been partial to those. I got a signal from her eyes and the tilt of her head, so I started weaving through the crowd to see if she wanted a drink. I was halfway there when the man in the white suit stepped in front of me. Up close, he looked like a pretty tough egg. His hair was bristling up the back in spite of what smelled like a whole bottle of wild root cream oil, and he had the flat, oddly shiny eyes that some deep sea fish have. "Want to talk to you outside," he said. The redhead looked away with a small pout. It can wait," I said. "Let me by."
"My name is Scully. Mike Scully."
I knew the name. Mike Scully was a small-time racketeer from Chi-Town who paid for his beer and Skittles by running booze in from Canada. The high-tension stuff started out where men wear skirts and play bagpipes when they aren't tending the vats, that is. His picture had been in the paper a few times. The last time had been when some other dance hall Dan tried to gun him down. "Now, you're pretty far from Chicago, my friend," I said.
"I brought some chaperones," he said. "Don't worry. Outside."
The redhead took another look. I pointed at Scully and shrugged. She sniffed and turned her back. "Ah, there," I said. "You queered that."
"Bimbos like that are a penny a bushel in Chi," he said.
"I don't want a bushel."
"Outside."
I followed him out. The air was cool on my skin after the smoky atmosphere of the club, sweet with fresh-cut alfalfa. And the stars were out. Soft and flickering. The hoods were out, too, but they didn't look soft, and the only things flickering were their cigarettes.
"I got a job for you," Scully said.
"Is that so?"
"Pays 2 C's. Split it with the band or hold back 100 for yourself."
"What is it?"
"A gig. What else?" "My sis is tying a knot. I want you to play for the reception. She likes Dixieland. Two of my boys say you play good Dixieland."
I told you Englander was good to work for. He was paying us $80 a week. This guy was offering over twice that for one gig.
"It's from 5 to 8 next Friday," Scully said.
at the Sons of Aaron Hall on Grover Street. That's too much, I said. How come? There's two reasons, Scully said. He puffed on his pipe. I looked out of place in the middle of that yegg's face. He should have had a lucky strike green dangling from that mouth, or maybe a sweet caporal, the cigarette of bums. And with that pipe, he didn't look like a bum. Now, the pipe made him look sad and funny. Two reasons, he repeated. Maybe you heard the Greek try to rub me out. Yeah, I saw your picture in the paper, I said. You were the guy trying to crawl into the sidewalk. Smart guy, he growled, but with no real force. I'm getting too big for him. The Greek is getting old. He thinks small. He ought to be back in the old country drinking olive oil and looking at the Pacific. I think it's the Aegean, I said. I don't give a tin shit if it's Lake Huron, he said. Point is, he don't want to be old. He still wants to get me. He don't know the coming thing when he sees it. That's you. You're fucking A. In other words, you're paying two C's because our last number might be arranged for Enfield rifle accompaniment. Anger flashed in his face, but there was something else there as well. I didn't know what it was then, but I think I do now. I think it was sorrow. But, E.G., I got the best protection money can buy. If anyone sticks his nose in, he won't get a chance to sniff twice. What's the other thing? He spoke softly. My sister's marrying an Italian.
A good Catholic like you, I sneered softly.
The anger flashed again, white hot, and for a minute I thought I'd pushed him too far. A good Mick! A good old shanty Irish Mick, sonny, and you better not forget it!
To that he added, almost too low to be heard.
Even if I did lose most of my hair, it was red.
I started to say something, but he didn't give me a chance. He swung me around and pressed his face down until our noses almost touched. I have never seen such anger and humiliation and rage and determination in a man's face. You never see that look on a white face these days. How it is to be hurt, made to feel small. Oh, all that love and hate. But I saw it on his face that night, and knew I could crack wise a few more times and get my ass killed.
She's fat, he half-whispered, and I could smell checkerberry mints on his breath. A lot of people have been laughing at me while my back was turned. They don't do it to me when I can see them, though. I'll tell you that, Mr. Cornet Player. Because maybe this Dago is all she could get, but you're not going to laugh at me or her or the Dago, and nobody else is either, because you're going to be playing too loud. No one is going to laugh at my sis.
Well, we never laugh when we play our gigs. It makes it too hard to pucker. That relieved the tension. He laughed, a short, barking laugh.
Ha! Now you be there, ready to play at 5. The Sons of Aaron on Grover Street. I'll pay your expenses both ways, too.
He wasn't asking. I felt railroaded into the decision, but he wasn't giving me time to talk it over. He was already striding away, and one of his chaperones was holding open the back door of a Packard coupe. They drove away. I stayed out a while longer and had a smoke. The evening was soft and fine, and Scully seemed more and more like something I might have dreamed. I was just wishing we could bring the bandstand out to the parking lot and play when Biff tapped me on the shoulder. Time, he said. Okay. We went back in. The redhead had picked up some salt-and-pepper sailor who looked twice her age. I don't know what a member of the U.S. Navy was doing in Illinois, but as far as I was concerned, she could have him if her taste was that bad. Ah, I didn't feel so good. The rye had gone to my head, and Scully seemed a lot more real in here. The fumes of what he and his kind sold were strong enough to float on. We had a request for Camptown Races, Charlie said. Forget it, I said curtly. We don't play that nigga stuff till after midnight. I could see Billy Boy stiffen as he was sitting down at the piano, and then his face was smooth again. I could have kicked myself around the block, but God damn it, a man can't shift gears on his mouth overnight. Or in a year. Or maybe even in 10. And in those days, nigga was a word I hated and kept on saying. I went over to him. I'm sorry, Bill. I haven't been myself tonight.
Sure,
he said. But his eyes looked over my shoulder, and I knew my apology wasn't accepted. That was bad, but I'll tell you what was worse. Knowing he was disappointed in me. I told him about the gig during our next break, being square with him about the money and how Scully was a hoodlum, although I didn't tell him about the other hood who was out to get him. I also told him that Scully's sister was fat, and Scully was sensitive about it. Anyone who cracked any jokes about inland barges might wind up with a third breather hole, somewhat above the other two. I kept looking at Billy Boy Williams while I talked, but you could read nothing on that cat's face. It'd be easier trying to figure out what a walnut was thinking by reading the wrinkles on the shell. Billy Boy was the best piano player we ever had, and we were all sorry about the little ways it got taken out on him as we traveled from one place to another. Ugh, in the South, it was the worst, of course. Jim Crow car, nigger heaven at the movies, stuff like that. But it wasn't that great in the North either. But what can I do, huh? You go on and tell me. In those days, you lived with those differences. We turned up at the Sons of Aaron Hall on Friday at 4 o'clock, an hour before. We drove up in the special Ford truck Biff and Manny and me put together. The back end was all enclosed with canvas, and there were two cots bolted on the floor. We even had an electric hot plate that ran off the battery, and the band's name was painted on the outside. The day was just right. A ham and egger if you ever saw one, with little white summer clouds casting shadows on the fields. But once we got into the city, it was hot and kind of grim. All of the hustle and bustle you get out of touch with in a place like Morgan. By the time we got to the hall, my clothes were sticking to me, and I needed to visit the comfort station. I could have used a shot of Tommy Englander's rye, too. The Sons of Aaron was a big wooden building, affiliated with the church where Scully's sis was getting married. You know the sort of place I mean, if you ever took the wafer, I guess. CYO meetings on Tuesdays, bingo on Wednesdays, and a sociable for the kids on Saturday nights. We trooped up the walk, each of us carrying his instrument in one hand and some part of Biff's drum kit in the other. A thin lady with no breastworks to speak of was directing traffic inside. Two sweating men were hanging crepe paper. There was a bandstand at the front of the hall, and over it was a banner with a couple of big pink paper wedding bells. The tinsel lettering on the banner said, "Best always, Maureen and Rico." Maureen and Rico? Damned if I couldn't see why Scully was so wound up. Maureen and Rico. Stone of crows. The thin lady swooped down on us. She looked like she had a lot to say, so I beat her to the punch. "With a band," I said. "The band?" She blinked at our instruments distrustfully. "Oh, I was hoping you were the caterers." I smiled, as if the caterers always carried snare drums and trombone cases. "You can..." she began, but just then a rough, tough cream puff of about 19 strolled over. A cigarette was dangling from the corner of his mouth, but so far as I could see, it wasn't doing a thing for his image except making his left eye water.
"Open that shit up," he said.
Charlie and Biff looked at me. I shrugged. We opened our cases, and he looked at the horns. Seeing nothing that looked like he could load it and fire it, he wandered back to his corner and sat down on a folding chair. "You can set your things up right away," the thin lady went on, as if she'd never been interrupted. "There's a piano in the other room. I'll have my men wheel it in when we're done putting up our decorations." Biff was already lugging his drum kit up onto the little stage. "I thought you were the caterers," she repeated in a distraught way. "Mr. Scully ordered a wedding cake, and there are hors d'oeuvres and roast beef, and then..."
"They'll be here, ma'am," I said.
"They get payment on delivery. Two roasts of pork and a capon, and Mr. Scully will be just furious if..." She saw one of her men pausing to light his cigarette just below a dangling streamer of crepe and shrieked, "Henry!" The man jumped as if he had been shot. I escaped to the bandstand. We were all set up by 4:45. Charlie, the trombone player, was wah-wahing away into a mute, and Biff was loosening up his wrists. The caterers had arrived at 4:20, and Miss Gibson, that was the thin lady's name, she made a business out of such affairs, almost threw herself on him. Four long tables had been set up and covered with white linen, and four black women in caps and aprons were setting places. The cake had been wheeled into the middle of the room for everyone to gasp over. It was 6 layers high, with a little bride and groom standing on top. I walked outside to grab a fag, and just about halfway through, I heard them coming, tooting away and raising a racket. I stayed where I was until I saw the lead car coming around the corner of the block below the church, then I snuffed my smoke and went inside. "They're coming," I told Miss Gibson. She went white and actually swayed on her heels. There was a lady who should have taken up a different profession, interior decoration maybe, a library science. "The tomato juice!" she screamed. "Bring the tomato juice!" I went back to the bandstand and we got ready. We'd played gigs like this before. What combo hasn't? And when the doors opened, we swung into a ragtime version of the wedding march that I had arranged myself. If you think that sort of sounds like a lemonade cocktail, I have to agree with you. But most receptions we played for just ate it up, and this one was no different. Everyone clapped and yelled and whistled, and they started gassing amongst themselves. But I could tell by the way some of them were tapping their feet while they talked that we were getting through. We were on. I thought it was going to be a good gig. I know everything they say about the Irish, and most of it's true, but hot damn, they can't not have a good time once they are set up for it. All the same, I have to admit, I almost blew the whole number when the groom and the blushing bride walked in. Scully, dressed in a morning coat and striped trousers, shot me a hard look, and don't think I didn't see it. I managed to keep a poker face, and the rest of the band did, too. No one so much as missed a note. Lucky for us. The wedding party, which looked as if it were made up almost entirely of Scully's goons and their mauls, were wise already. They had to be, if they'd been at the church. But I'd only heard faint rumblings, you might say. You've heard about Jack Spratt and his wife. Well, this was 100 times worse. Scully's sister had the red hair he was losing, and it was long and curly, but not that pretty auburn shade you may be imagining. No, this was County Cork red, bright as a carrot and kinky as a bedspring. Her natural complexion was curd white, but she was wearing almost too many freckles to tell. And had Scully said she was fat? Brother, that was like saying you could buy a few things in Macy's. She was a human dinosaur. 350 pounds if she was one. It had all gone to her bosom and hips and butt and thighs, like it usually does on fat girls, making what should be sexy grotesque and sort of frightening instead. Some fat girls have pathetically pretty faces, but Scully's sister didn't even have that. Her eyes were too close together, her mouth was too big, and she had jug ears. Then there were the freckles. Even thin, she would have been ugly enough to stop a clock. Hell, a whole show window of them. That alone wouldn't have made anybody laugh unless they were stupid or just poison mean. Oh, it was when you added the groom, Rico, to the picture that you wanted to laugh until you cried. He could have put on a top hat and still stood in the top half of her shadow. He looked like he might have weighed 90 pounds or so, soaking wet. He was skinny as a rail, his complexion darkly olive. When he grinned around nervously, his teeth looked like a picket fence in a slum neighborhood. We kept right on playing. Scully roared, "The bride and groom! God give them every happiness!" And if God don't, his thundering brow proclaimed, "You folks hear better, at least today." Everyone shouted their approval and applauded. We finished our number with a flourish, and that brought another round. Scully's sister Maureen smiled. God, her mouth was big. Rico simpered. For a while, everyone just walked around, eating cheese and cold cuts on crackers and drinking Scully's best bootleg scotch. I had 3 shots myself between numbers, and it put Tommy Englander's rye in the shade. Scully began to look happier, too. A little, anyway. He cruised by the bandstand once and said, "Ah, you guys play pretty good." Coming from a music lover like him, I reckon that was a real compliment. Just before everyone sat down to the meal, Maureen came up herself. She was even uglier up close, and her white gown, there must have been enough white satin wrapped around that mama to cover 3 beds, wasn't helping her at all. She asked us if we could play Roses of Picardy, like Red Nichols and his Five Pennies, because she said it was her very favorite song. Fat and ugly she was, but hoity-toity she was not, unlike some of the two bidders had been dropping by to make requests. We played it, but not very well. Still, she gave us a sweet smile that was almost enough to make her pretty, and she applauded when it was done. They sat down to dinner around 6:15, and Miss Gibson's hired help rolled the chow to them. They fell to like a bunch of animals, which was not entirely surprising, and kept knocking back that high-tension booze the whole time. I couldn't help watching the way Maureen was eating. I tried to look away, but my eye kept wandering back, as if to make sure it was seeing what it thought it was seeing. Now, the rest of them were packing it in, but she made them look like old ladies in a tea room. She had no more time for sweet smiles or listening to Roses of Picardy. You could have stuck a sign in front of her that said, "Woman Working." That lady didn't need a knife and fork. She needed a steam shovel and a conveyor belt. It was sad to watch her. And Rico, you could just see his chin over the table where the bride was sitting, and a pair of brown eyes, as shy as a deer's, kept handing her things, never changing that nervous simper. We took a 20-minute break while the cake-cutting ceremony was going on, and Miss Gibson herself fed us in the kitchen. It was hot as blazes with the cook stove on, and none of us was too hungry. The gig had started out feeling right, and now it felt wrong. I could see it on my band's faces, and on Miss Gibson's, too, for that matter. By the time we returned to the bandstand, the drinking had begun in earnest. Tough-looking guys staggered around with silly grins on their mugs or stood in corners haggling over racing forms. Some couples wanted the Charleston, so we played Ed Hager's Blues. Those goons ate it up. And I'm Gonna Charleston Back to Charleston and some other numbers like that, jazz baby stuff. The Debs rocked around the floor, flashing their rolled hose and shaking their fingers beside their faces and yelling, "Fododeodo." Ugh, a phrase that makes me feel like sicking up my supper to this very day. It was getting dark out. The screens had fallen off some of the windows, and moths came in and flitted around the light fixtures and clouds. And as the song says, the band played on. The bride and groom stood in the sidelines. Neither of them seemed interested in slipping away early, almost completely neglected. Even Scully seemed to have forgotten about him. He was pretty drunk. It was almost 8 o'clock when the little fellow crept in. I spotted him immediately because he was sober and he looked scared. Scared as a nearsighted cat in a dog pound. He walked up to Scully, who was talking with some floozy right by the bandstand, and tapped him on the shoulder. Scully wheeled around, and I heard every word they said. Believe me, I wish I hadn't.
"Who the hell are you?"
Scully asked rudely.
"My name is Demetrius," the fella said. "Demetrius Katsenos. I come from the Greek."
Motion on the floor came to a dead stop. Jacket buttons were freed and hands stole out of sight under lapels. I saw Manny looking nervous. Hell, I didn't feel so calm myself. We kept on playing, though, you bet.
"Is that right?" Scully said quietly, almost reflectively.
The guy burst out.
"I didn't want to come, Mr. Scully. The Greek. He has my wife. He said he'd kill her if I don't give you his message."
"What message?" Scully growled. The thunderclouds were back on his forehead.
"He said..."
The guy paused with an agonized expression. His throat worked as if the words were physical things caught in there and choking him.
"He said to tell you your sister is one fat pig. He say...
His eyes rolled wildly at Scully's still expression. I shot a look at Maureen. She looked as if she'd been slapped.
"He say she got an itch. He say if a fat woman got an itch on her back, she'd buy a back scratcher. He say if a woman got an itch in her parts, she'd buy a man."
Maureen gave a great strangled cry and ran out, weeping. The floor shook. Rico padded after her, his face bewildered. He was wringing his hands. Scully had grown so red his cheeks were actually purple.
I half expected, maybe more than half expected, his brains to just blow out his ears. I saw that same look of mad agony I'd seen in the dark outside of Englander's. Maybe he was just a cheap hood, but I felt sorry for him. You would have, too. When he spoke, his voice was very quiet, almost mild. Is there more? The little Greek man quailed. His voice was splintery with anguish. Please, don't kill me, Mr. Scully. My wife. The Greek, he got my wife. I don't want to say these things. He got my wife, my woman. I ain't gonna hurt you, Scully said, quiet as still. Just tell me the rest. He say the whole town laughing at you. We had stopped playing, and there was dead silence for a second. Then Scully turned his eyes to the ceiling. Both of his hands were shaking and held out, clenched in front of him. He was holding them in fists so tight, it seemed I could see his hamstrings standing out right through his shirt.
All right! He screamed. All right!
He broke for the door. Two of his men tried to stop him, tried to tell him it was suicide. Just what the Greek wanted, but Scully was like a crazy man. He knocked them down and rushed out into the black summer night. In the dead quiet that followed, all I could hear was the messenger's tortured breathing, and somewhere out back, the soft sobbing of the bride. Just about then, the young kid who had braced us when we came in uttered a curse and made for the door. He was the only one. Before he could even get under the big paper shamrock hanging in the foyer, automobile tires screeched up on the pavement and engines revved up. A lot of engines. It sounded like Memorial Day at the brickyard out there. Oh, dear to Jesus! The kid screamed from the doorway. It's a fucking caravan! Get down, boss! Get down! Get down! The night exploded with gunfire. It was like World War I out there for maybe a minute, maybe two. Bullets stitched across the open door of the hall, and one of the hanging light globes overhead exploded. Outside, the night was bright with Winchester fireworks, and the cars howled away. One of the malls was brushing broken glass out of a bobbed hair. Now that the danger was over, the rest of the goons rushed out. The door to the kitchen banged open, and Maureen ran through again. Everything she had was jiggling. Her face was more puffy than ever. Rico came in awake like a bewildered valet, and he went out the door. Miss Gibson appeared in the empty hall, her eyes wide and shocked. The little man who'd started all the trouble with his singing telegram had pouted. "It was shooting," Miss Gibson murmured. "What happened?" "I think the Greek just cooled the paymaster," Biff said. She looked at me, bewildered, but before I could translate, Billy Boy said in his soft, polite voice,
"He means that Mr. Scully just got rubbed out, Miss Gibson."
Miss Gibson stared at him, her eyes getting wider and wider, and then she fainted dead away. I felt a little like fainting myself. Just then, from outside, came the most anguished scream I have ever heard, then or since. Oh, that unholy caterwauling just went on and on. You didn't have to peek out the door to know who was tearing her heart out in the street, keening over her dead brother even while the cops and news hawks were on their way. "Let's blow," I muttered, "quick." We had it packed in before 5 minutes had passed. Some of the goons came back inside, but they were too drunk or too scared to notice the likes of us. We went out the back, each of us carrying a part of Biff's drum kit. Quite a parade we must have made, walking up the street for anyone who saw us. I led the way with my horn case tucked under my arm and a cymbal in each hand. And the boy stood on the corner at the end of the block while I went back for the truck. The cops hadn't shown yet. The big girl was still crouched over the body of her brother in the middle of the street, wailing like a banshee while her tiny groom ran around her like a moon orbiting a big planet. I drove down to the corner, and the boys threw everything in the back, willy-nilly. Then we hauled ass out of there. We averaged 45 miles an hour all the way back to Morgan, back roads or not, and either Scully's goons must have never bothered to tip the cops to us, or else the cops didn't care, because we never heard from them.
We never got that $200 either. She came into Tommy Englander's about 10 days later.